Lucilla realized then that Tag had insinuated himself further into her psyche than she should permit. Grimly, she swung her gaze to the tall figure emerging from the doorway's shadows. Duncan already was running toward the Bashar. As Lucilla focused on Tag, reaction flashed through her, ignited by the most elemental Bene Gesserit responses. The steps of this reaction could be defined later. Something wrong. Danger. Tag is not Tag. In the reactive flash, however, none of this took separate form. She responded, hurling all the volume of voice she could muster. Duncan! Down! Duncan dropped flat on the grass, his attention riveted to the Tag figure emerging from the weapons wing. There was a field model laser gun in the man's hands. Face dancer, Lucilla thought. Only hyper-alertness revealed him to her. One of the new ones. Face dancer, Lucilla shouted. Duncan kicked himself sideways and leaped up, twisting flat in the air at least a meter off the ground. The speed of his reaction shocked Lucilla. She had not known any human could move that fast. The laser gun's first bolt cut beneath Duncan as he seemed to float in the air. Lucilla jumped to the parapet and dropped to a handhold on the window ledge of the next lower level. Before she was stopped, her right hand shot out and found the protruding rain spout that memory told her was there. Her body arched sideways, and she dropped to a window ledge at the next level. Desperation drove her, even though she knew she would be too late. Something crackled on the wall above her. She saw molten line cut toward her as she flung herself to the left, twisting and dropping onto the lawn. Her gaze captured the scene around her in a flashing Diet grasp as she landed. Duncan moved toward the attacker, dodging and twisting in a terrifying replay of his practice session. The speed of his movements. Lucilla saw indecision in the face of the false Tag. She darted toward the face dancer, feeling the creature's thoughts. Two of them after me. Failure was inevitable, though, and Lucilla knew it even as she ran. The face dancer had only to shift his weapon into full burn at close range. He could lace the air in front of him. Nothing could penetrate such a defense. As she cast about in her mind, desperately seeking some way to defeat the attacker, she saw red smoke appear on the false Tag's breast. A line of red darted upward at an oblique angle through the muscles of the arm holding the laser gun. The arm fell away like a piece dropping from a statue. The shoulder tipped away from the torso in a spout of blood. The figure toppled, dissolving into more red smoke and blood spray, crumbling into pieces on the steps, all dark tans and blue-tinged reds. Lucilla smelled the distinctive face dancer pheromones as she stopped. Duncan came up beside her. He peered past the dead face dancer at movement in the hallway. Another Tag emerged behind the dead one. Lucilla identified the reality. Tag himself. That's the Bashar, Duncan said. Lucilla experienced a small surge of pleasure that Duncan had learned this identity lesson so well. How to recognize your friends, even if you only saw bits of them. She pointed to the dead face dancer. Smell him. Duncan inhaled. Yes, I have it. But he wasn't a very good copy. I saw what he was as soon as you did. Tag emerged into the courtyard carrying a heavy laser gun cradled across his left arm. His right hand held a firm grip on the stock and trigger. He swept his gaze around the courtyard, then focused on Duncan, and finally on Lucilla. Bring Duncan inside, Tag said. It was the order of a battlefield commander, depending only on superior knowledge of what should be done in the emergency. Lucilla obeyed without question. Duncan did not speak as she led him by the hand past the bloody meat that had been the face dancer, then into the weapons wing. Once inside, he glanced back at the sodden heap and asked, "Who let him in?" not... How did he get in? She observed. Duncan had already seen past the inconsequentials to the heart of their problem. Tegg strode ahead of them toward his own quarters. He stopped at the door, glanced inside, and motioned for Lucilla and Duncan to follow. In Tegg's bedroom, there was the thick smell of burned flesh and wisps of smoke, dominated by the charred barbecue odor that Lucilla so detested, cooked human meat. A figure in one of Tegg's uniforms lay face down on the floor, where it had fallen off his bed. Tegg rolled the figure over with one boot toe, exposing the face, staring eyes, a rictus grin. Lucilla recognized one of the perimeter guards, one of those who had come to the keep with Shuangyu, so the keep's record said. "Their point man," Tegg said. "Patrine took care of him, and we put one of my uniforms on him. It was enough to fool the face dancers, because we didn't let him see the face before we attacked. They didn't have time to make a memory print."
"You know about that?"
Lucilla was startled. "Belanda briefed me thoroughly." Abruptly, Lucilla saw the further significance of what Tegg said. She suppressed a swift flare of anger. "How did you let one of them get into the courtyard?" His voice mild, Tegg said, "There was rather urgent activity in here. I had to make a choice, which turned out to be the right one." She did not try to hide her anger.
"The choice to let Duncan fend for himself?"
"To leave him in your care, or let other attackers get themselves firmly entrenched inside. Patrine and I had a bad time clearing this wing. We had our hands full." Tegg glanced at Duncan. "He came through very well, thanks to our training."
That thing almost got him."
"Lucilla," Tegg shook his head, "I had it timed. You two could last at least a minute out there. I knew you would throw yourself in that thing's path and sacrifice yourself to save Duncan. Another 20 seconds. At Tegg's words, Duncan turned a shiny-eyed look on Lucilla. "Would you have done that?" When Lucilla did not respond, Tegg said, "She would have done that." Lucilla did not deny it. She remembered now, though, the incredible speed with which Duncan had moved, the dazzling shifts of his attack. "Battle decisions," Tegg said, looking at Lucilla. She accepted this. As usual, Tegg had made the correct choice. She knew, though, that she would have to communicate with Terraza. The prana bindu accelerations in the Skola went beyond anything she had expected. She stiffened as Tegg straightened to full alert, his gaze on the doorway behind her. Lucilla whirled. Shuangyu stood there, Patrine behind her, another heavy laser gun over his arm. Its muzzle, Lucilla noted, was aimed at Shuangyu.
"She insisted," Patrine said.
There was an angry set to the old aide's face, the deep lines beside his mouth pointed downward.
"There's a trail of bodies clear out to the south pillbox," Shuangyu said. "Your people won't let me out there to inspect. I command you to countermand those orders immediately."
"Not until my cleanup crews are finished," Tegg said.
"They're still killing people out there. I can hear it."
A venomous edge had entered Shuangyu's voice. She glared at Lucilla. "We're also questioning people out there," Tegg said. Shuangyu shifted her glare to Tegg.
"If it's too dangerous here, then we will take the child to my quarters. Now."
"We will not do that," Tegg said. His tone was low-key, but positive. Shuangyu stiffened with displeasure. Patrine's knuckles went white on the stock of his laser gun. Shuangyu swung her gaze past the gun and up to Lucilla's appraising stare. The two women looked into each other's eyes. Tegg allowed the moment to hold for a beat, then said, "Lucilla, take Duncan into my sitting room." He nodded toward a door behind him. Lucilla obeyed, pointedly keeping her body between Shuang Yu and Duncan the whole time. Once behind the closed door, Duncan said, "She almost called me the Gola. She's really upset." "Shuang Yu has let several things slip past her guard," Lucilla said. She glanced around Teg's sitting room, her first view of this part of his quarters, the Bashar's inner sanctum. It reminded her of her own quarters, the same mixture of orderliness and casual disarray. Reading spools lay in a clutter on a small table, beside an old-fashioned chair upholstered in soft gray. The spool reader had been swung aside, as though its user had just stepped out for a moment, intending to return soon. A Bashar's black uniform jacket lay across a nearby hard chair, with sewing material in a small open box atop it. The jacket's cuff showed a carefully patched hole. So he does his own mending. This was an aspect of the famous Miles Teg she had not expected. If she had thought about it, she would have said Patrine would absorb such chores. "Shuang Yu let the attackers in, didn't she?" Duncan asked. "Her people did." Lucilla did not hide her anger. "She has gone too far. A pact with the Tlilazu. Will Patrine kill her?" "I don't know, nor do I care." Outside the door, Shuang Yu spoke with anger, her voice loud and quite clear. "Are we just going to wait here, Bashar? You can leave any time you wish." That was Teg. "But I can't enter the south tunnel." Shuang Yu sounded petulant. Lucilla knew it was something the old woman did deliberately. What was she planning? Teg must be very cautious now. He had been clever out there, revealing for Lucilla the gaps in Shuang Yu's control. But they had not plumbed Shuang Yu's resources. Lucilla wondered if she should leave Duncan here and return to Teg's side. Teg said, "You can go now, but I advise you not to return to your quarters."
"And why not?"
Shuang Yu sounded surprised, really surprised and not covering it well. "One moment," Teg said. Lucilla became aware of shouting at a distance. A heavy thumping explosion sounded from nearby, and then another one more distant. Dust sifted from the cornice above the door to Teg's sitting room.
"What was that?"
Shuang Yu again, her voice overly loud. Lucilla moved to place herself between Duncan and the wall to the hallway. Duncan stared at the door, his body poised for defense. "That first blast was what I expected them to do." Teg again. "The second, I fear, was what they did not expect." A whistle piped nearby loudly enough to cover something Shuang Yu said.
"That's it, Bashar," Patrine.
"What is happening?"
Shuang Yu demanded.
"The first explosion, dear Reverend Mother, was your quarters being destroyed by our attackers. The second explosion was us destroying the attackers."
"I just got the signal, Bashar," Patrine again. "We got them all. They came down by floater from the no-ship, just as you expected."
"The ship?"
Teg's voice was full of angry demand. "Destroyed the instant it came through the space fold. No survivors."
"You fools!"
Shuang Yu screamed.
"Do you know what you've done?"
"I carried out my orders to protect that boy from any attack," Teg said. "By the way, weren't you supposed to be in your quarters at this hour?"
"What?"
"They were after you when they blasted your quarters. The Tlilazu are very dangerous, Reverend Mother."
"I don't believe you."
"I suggest you go look. Patrine, let her pass." As she listened, Lucilla heard the unspoken argument. The Mentat Bashar had been trusted here more than a Reverend Mother, and Shuang Yu knew it. She would be desperate. That was clever, suggesting her quarters had been destroyed. She might not believe it, though. Foremost in Shuang Yu's mind now would be the realization that both Teg and Lucilla recognized her complicity in the attack, There was no telling how many others were aware of this. Bertrine knew, of course. Duncan stared at the closed door, his head tipped slightly to the right. There was a curious expression on his face, as though he saw through the door and actually watched the people out there. Shuang Yu spoke, the most careful control in her voice.
I don't believe my quarters were destroyed.
She knew Lucilla was listening. There is only one way to make sure, Teck said. Clever, Lucilla thought. Shuang Yu could not make a decision until she was certain whether the Tlilazu had acted treacherously.
You will wait here for me, then. That's an order.
Lucilla heard the swish of Shuang Yu's robes as the Reverend Mother departed. Very bad emotional control, Lucilla thought. What this revealed about Teg, though, was equally disturbing. He did it to her. Teg had kept a Reverend Mother off balance. The door in front of Duncan swung open. Teg stood there, one hand on the latch.
Quick, Teg said. We must be out of the keep before she returns.
Out of the keep? Lucilla did not hide her shock.
Quick, I say. Bertrine has prepared a way for us. But I must... You must nothing. Come as you are. Follow me, or we'll be forced to take you.
Do you really think you could take a... Lucilla broke off. This was a new Teg in front of her, and she knew he would not have made such a threat unless he was prepared to carry it out.
Very well, she said.
She took Duncan's hand and followed Teg out of his quarters. Bertrine stood in the hallway looking to his right.
She's gone, the old man said.
He looked at Teg.
You know what to do, Bashar.
At. Lucilla had never before heard Teg use the Batman's diminutive name. Bertrine grinned, a gleaming, full-toothed smile.
Sorry, Bashar. The excitement, you know. I'll leave you to it, then. I have my part to play.
Teg waved Lucilla and Duncan down the hallway to the right. She obeyed and heard Teg close on her heels. Duncan's hand was sweaty in her hand. He pulled free and strode beside her without looking back. The suspensor drop at the end of the hallway was guarded by two of Teg's own people. He nodded to them.
Nobody follows.
They spoke in unison. Right, Bashar. Lucilla realized as she entered the drop with Duncan and Teg that she had chosen sides in a dispute whose workings she did not fully understand. She could feel the movement of the Sisterhood's politics like a swift current of water pouring all around her. Usually, the movement remained mostly a gentle wave washing the strand, but now she sensed a great destructive surge preparing to thunder its surf upon her. Duncan spoke as they emerged into the sorting chamber for the South Pillbox.
We should all be armed, he said.
We will be very soon, Teg said. And I hope you're prepared to kill anyone who tries to stop us.
The significant fact is this. No Bene Tlilax female has ever been seen away from the protection of their core planets. Face dancer mules who simulate females do not count in this analysis. They cannot be breeders. The Tlilazu sequester their females to keep them from our hands. This is our primary deduction. It must also be in the eggs that the Tlilazu masters conceal their most essential secrets. Bene Gesserit analysis, archives number XOXTM99041.
So we meet at last, Terraza said.
She stared across the 2 meters of open space between their chairs at Tilewith Wath. Her analysts assured her that this man was Tlilazu Master of Masters. What an elfin little figure he was to hold so much power. The prejudices of appearance must be discarded here, she warned herself.
Some would not believe this possible, Wath said.
He had a piping little voice, Terraza noted, something else to be measured by different standards. They sat in the neutrality of a guild no-ship, with Bene Gesserit and Lilazu monitors clinging to the guild ship's hull, like predatory birds on a carcass. The guild had been cravenly anxious to placate the Bene Gesserit. You will pay. The guild knew. Payment had been extracted from them before. The small oval room in which they met was conventionally copper-walled and spy-proof. Terraza did not believe this for an instant. She presumed also that the bonds between Guild and Lilazu, forged of melange, still existed in full force. Waff did not try to delude himself about Terraza. This woman was far more dangerous than any honored mater. If he killed Terraza, she would be replaced immediately by someone just as dangerous. Someone with every essential piece of information possessed by the present Mother Superior. We find your new face dancers very interesting, Terraza said. Waff grimaced involuntarily. Yes, far more dangerous than the honored maters, who were not yet even blaming the Tlilazu for the loss of an entire no-ship. Terraza glanced at the small, double-faced digital clock on the low side table at her right, a position where the clock could be read easily by either of them. The WAF side face had been matched to his internal clock. She noted that the two internal time readings stood within 10 seconds of synchronization at an arbitrary mid-afternoon. It was one of the niceties of this confrontation where even the positioning and spacing between their chairs had been specified in the arrangements. The two of them were alone in the room. The oval space around them was about 6 meters in its long dimension, half that in width. They occupied identical sling chairs of peg-fastened wood, which supported orange fabric. Not a bit of metal or other foreign material in either of them. The only other furnishing of the room was the side table with its clock. The table was a thin black surface of plaz on 3 spindly wooden legs. Each of the principals in this meeting had been snooped with care. Each had 3 personal guards outside the room's 1 hatch. Terraza did not think that Lilazu would try a face-dancer exchange, not under the present circumstances. You will pay. The Tlilazu, too, were extremely aware of their vulnerability, especially now that they knew a reverend mother could expose the new face dancers. Waff cleared his throat. I do not expect us to reach an agreement, he said. Then why did you come? I seek an explanation of this odd message we have received from your keep on Rakis. For what are we supposed to pay? I beg of you, Sir Waff, drop these foolish pretenses in this room. There are facts known to both of us that cannot be avoided. Such as? No female of the Bene Tlilax has ever been provided to us for breeding. And she thought, let him sweat that one. It was damnably frustrating not to have a line of Tlilazu other memories for Bene Gesserit investigation, and Waff would know it. Waff scowled. Surely you don't think I would bargain with the life of... He broke off and shook his head. I cannot believe this is the payment you would ask. When Terraza did not respond, Waff said, The stupid attack on the Rakian temple was undertaken independently by people on the scene. They have been punished. Expected Gambit number 3, Terraza thought. She had participated in numerous analysis briefings before this meeting, if one could call them briefings. Analyses there had been in excess. Very little was known about this Tlilazu master, this Tilewith Waff. Some extremely important optional projections had been arrived at by inference, if these proved to be true. The trouble was that some of the most interesting data came from unreliable sources. One salient fact could be depended upon, however. The elfin figure seated across from her was deadly dangerous. Waff's Gambit number 3 engaged her attention. It was time to respond. Terraza produced a knowing smile.
That is precisely the kind of lie we expected from you, she said. Do we begin with insults? He spoke without heat. You set the pattern. Let me warn you that you will not be able to deal with us the way you dealt with those horrors from the scattering. Waff's frozen stare invited Terraza to a daring gambit. The Sisterhood's deductions, based partly on the disappearance of an Ixion conference ship, were accurate. Maintaining her same smile, she now pursued the optional conjecture line as though it were known fact. I think, she said, the whores might like to learn that they have had face dancers among them. Waff suppressed his anger. These damnable witches, they knew. Somehow they knew. His counselors had been extremely doubtful about this meeting. A substantial minority had recommended against it. The witches were so devilish. And their retaliations. Time to shift his attention to Gamble, Terraza thought. Keep him off balance. She said, even when you subvert one of us, as you did with Shuangyu on Gamu, you learn nothing of value. Waff flared. She thought to hire us like a band of assassins. We only taught her a lesson. Ah, his pride shows itself, Terraza thought. Interesting. The implications of a moral structure behind such pride must be explored. You've never really penetrated our ranks, Terraza said. And you have never penetrated the Tlilazu. Waff managed to produce this boast with passable calm. He needed time to think, to plan. Perhaps you would like to know the price of our silence, Terraza suggested. She took Waff's stony glare for agreement and added, for one thing, you will share with us everything you learn about those scattering spawned whores who call themselves honored maters. Waff shuddered. Much had been confirmed by killing the honored maters. The sexual intricacies. Only the strongest psyche could resist entanglement in such ecstasies. The potential of this tool was enormous. Must that be shared with these witches? Everything you learn from them, Terraza insisted. Why do you call them whores? They try to copy us, yet they sell themselves for power and make a mockery of everything we represent. Honored maters. They outnumber you at least 10,000 to 1. We have seen the evidence. One of us could defeat them all, Terraza said. Waff sat in silence, studying her. Was that merely a boast? You could never be sure when it came to the Bene Gesserit witches. They did things. The dark side of the magic universe belonged to them. On more than one occasion, the witches had blunted the Shariat. Was it God's will that the true believers pass through another trial? Terraza allowed the silence to continue building its own tensions. She sensed Waff's turmoil. It reminded her of the Sisterhood's preliminary conference in preparation for this meeting with him. Belanda had asked the question of deceptive simplicity. What do we really know about the Tlilazu? Terraza had felt the answer surge into every mind around the Chapter House conference table. We may know for sure only what they want us to know. None of her analysts could avoid the suspicion that the Tlilazu had deliberately created a masking image of themselves. Tlilazu intelligence had to be measured against the fact that they alone controlled the secret of the axolotl tanks. Was that a lucky accident, as some suggested? Then why had others been unable to duplicate this accomplishment in all of these millennia? Golas. Were the Tlilazu using the Gola process for their own kind of immortality? She could see suggestive hints in Waff's actions. Nothing definite, but highly suspicious. At the Chapter House conferences, Belanda had returned repeatedly to their basic suspicions, hammering at them. All of it. All of it, I say. Everything in our archives could be garbage fit only for slig fodder. This allusion had caused some of the more relaxed reverend mothers around the table to shudder. Sligs.
those slowly creeping crosses between giant slugs and pigs might provide meat for some of the most expensive meals in their universe. But the creatures themselves embodied everything the Sisterhood held repugnant about the Tlilazu. Sligs had been one of the earliest Bene Tlilac's barter items, a product grown in their tanks and formed with a helical core from which all life took its shapes. That the Bene Tlilacs made them added to the aura of obscenity around a creature whose multi-mouths ground incessantly on almost any garbage, passing that garbage swiftly into excrement that not only smelled of the sty, but was slimy. "The sweetest meat this side of heaven," Belanda had quoted from a Chom promotion. "And it comes from obscenity," Terraza had added. "Obscenity." Terraza thought of this as she stared at Waff. For what possible reason might people build around themselves a mask of obscenity? Waff's flare of pride could not be fitted neatly into that image. Waff coughed lightly into his hand. He felt the pressure of the seams where he had concealed two of his potent dart throwers. The minority among his counselors had advised, "As with the honored maters, the winner in this encounter with the Bene Gesserit will be the one who emerges carrying the most secret information about the other. Death of the opponent guarantees success." I might kill her, but what then? Three more full Reverend Mothers waited outside that hatch. Doubtless Terraza had a signal prepared for the instant the hatch was opened. Without that signal, violence and disaster were sure to ensue. He did not believe for an instant that even his new face dancers could overcome those Reverend Mothers out there. The witches would be on full alert. They would have recognized the nature of Waff's guards. "We will share," Waff said. The admissions implicit in this hurt him, but he knew he had no alternatives. Terraza's brag about relative abilities might be inaccurate because of its extreme claim, but he sensed truth in it nonetheless. He had no illusions, however, about what would ensue if the honored maters learned what had actually happened to their envoys. The missing no-ship could not yet be laid at the Tlilazu door. Ships did vanish. Deliberate assassination was another matter altogether. The honored maters surely would try to exterminate such a brash opponent, if only as an example. Tlilazu's return from the scattering said as much. Having seen honored maters, Waff now believed those stories. Terraza said, "My second agenda item for this meeting is our Gola." Waff squirmed in the sling chair. Terraza felt repelled by Waff's tiny eyes, the round face with its snub nose and two sharp teeth. "You have been killing our Golas to control the movement of a project in which you have no part other than to provide a single element," Terraza accused. Waff once more wondered if he must kill her. Was nothing hidden from these damnable witches? The implication that the Bene Gesserit had a traitor in the Tlilazu Corps could not be ignored. How else could they know? He said, "I assure you, Reverend Mother Superior, that the Gola..." "Assure me of nothing. We assure ourselves." A look of sadness on her face, Terraza shook her head slowly from side to side. "And you think we don't know that you sold us damaged goods?" Waff spoke quickly. "He meets every requirement imposed by your contract." Again, Terraza shook her head from side to side. This diminutive Tlilazu master had no idea what he was revealing here. "You have buried your own scheme in his psyche," Terraza said. "I warn you, Sir Waff, that if your alterations obstruct our design, we will wound you deeper than you think possible." Waff passed a hand across his face, feeling the perspiration on his forehead. Damnable witches. But she did not know everything. The Tlilazu returned from the scattering, and the honored maters she maligned so bitterly had provided the Tlilazu with a sexually loaded weapon that would not be shared, no matter the promises made here. Terraza digested Waff's reaction silently and decided on a bold lie. When we captured your Ixion conference ship, your new face dancers did not die quite fast enough. We learned a great deal. Waff poised himself on the edge of violence. Bullseye, Terraza thought. The bold lie had opened an avenue of revelation into one of the more outrageous suggestions from her advisors. It did not seem outrageous now. But Lilazu's ambition is to produce a complete Prana Bindu mimic, her advisor had suggested. Complete? All of the sisters of the conference had been astonished by the suggestion. It implied a form of mental copy going beyond the memory print about which they already knew. The advisor, Sister Hysterion from Archives, had come armed with a tightly organized list of supporting material. We already know that what an Ixion probe does mechanically, that Lilazu do with nerves and flesh. The next step is obvious. Seeing Waff's reaction to her bold lie, Terraza continued to watch him carefully. He was at his most dangerous right now. A look of rage came over Waff's face. The things the witches knew were too dangerous. He did not doubt Terraza's claim in the slightest. I must kill her, no matter the consequences to me. We must kill them all. Abominations. It's their word, and it describes them perfectly. Terraza correctly interpreted his expression. She spoke quickly. You are in absolutely no danger from us, as long as you do not injure our designs. Your religion, your way of life, those are your business. Waff hesitated, not so much from what Terraza said as from the reminder of her powers. What else did they know? To continue in a subservient position, though, after rejecting such an alliance with the honored Maters, and with ascendancy so near after all of those millennia. Dismay filled him. The minority among his counselors had been right after all. There can be no bond between our peoples. Any accord with Pawinda forces is a union based upon evil. Terraza still sensed the potential violence in him. Had she pushed him too far? She held herself in defensive readiness. An involuntary jerking of his arms alerted her. Weapons in his sleeves. Tlilazu's resources were not to be underestimated. Her snoopers had detected nothing. We know about the weapons you carry, she said. Another bold lie suggested itself. If you make a mistake now, the whores will also learn how you use those weapons. Waff took 3 shallow breaths. When he spoke, he had himself under control. We will not be Bene Gesserit's satellites. Terraza responded in an even-toned, soothing voice. I have not, by word or action, suggested such a role for you. She waited. There was no change in Waff's expression. No slightest shift in the unfocused glare he directed at her. You threaten us, he muttered. You demand that we share everything we... Share? She snapped. One does not share with unequal partners. And what would you share with us? He demanded. She spoke with the chiding tone she would use to a child. Serwath, ask yourself why you, a ruling member of your oligarchy, came to this meeting. His voice still firmly controlled, Waff countered, And why did you, Mother Superior of the Bene Gesserit, come here? She spoke mildly. To strengthen us. You did not say what you would share, he accused. You still hope for advantage. Terraza continued to watch him carefully. She had seldom sensed such suppressed rage in a human. Ask me openly what you want, she said. And you will give it out of your great generosity. I will negotiate. Where was the negotiation when you ordered me... Ordered me to...
You came here firmly resolved to break any agreement we made, she said. Not once have you tried to negotiate. You sit in front of someone willing to bargain with you, and you can only...
Bargain?
Wap's memory was hurled back to the honored mater's anger at that word. I said it, Terraza said. Bargain. Something like a smile twitched the corners of Wap's mouth. You think I have authority to bargain with you? Have a care, Sir Wap, she said. You have the ultimate authority. It resides in that final ability to destroy an opponent utterly. I have not threatened that, but you have. She glanced at his sleeves. Wap sighed. What a quandary. She was Powinda. How could one bargain with a Powinda?
We have a problem that cannot be resolved by rational means, Terraza said.
Wap hid his surprise. Those were the very words the honored mater had used. He cringed inwardly at what that might signify. Could Bene Gesserit and honored maters make common cause? Terraza's bitterness argued otherwise. But when were the witches to be trusted? Once more, Waff wondered if he dared sacrifice himself to eliminate this witch. What would it serve? Others among them surely knew what she knew. It would only precipitate the disaster. There was that internal dispute among the witches, but again, that might just be another ruse.
You ask us to share something, Terraza said. What if I were to offer you some of our prize human bloodlines?
There was no mistaking how Waff's interest quickened. He said,
Why should we come to you for such things? We have our tanks, and we can pick up genetic examples almost anywhere.
Examples of what? She asked. Waff sighed. You could never escape that Bene Gesserit's incisiveness. It was like a sword thrust. He guessed that he had revealed things to her that led naturally to the subject. The damage already had been done. She correctly deduced, or spies had told her, that the wild pool of human genes held little interest for the Tlevazu, with their more sophisticated knowledge of life's innermost language. It never paid to underestimate either the Bene Gesserit or the products of their breeding programs. God himself knew they had produced Moadib and the Prophet.
What more would you demand in exchange for this? He asked.
Bargaining at last, Terraza said.
We both know, of course, that I am offering breeding mothers of the Atreides line.
And she thought, let him hope for that. They will look like Atreides, but they will not be Atreides. Wav felt his pulse quicken. Was this possible? Did she have the slightest idea what the Tlilazu might learn from an examination of such source material?
We would want first selection of their offspring, Terraza said.
No.
Alternate first selection, then?
Perhaps.
What do you mean, perhaps?
She leaned forward. Wav's intensity told her she was on a hot trail.
What else would you ask of us?
Our breeding mothers must have unfettered access to your genetic laboratories.
Are you mad?
Waff shook his head in exasperation. Did she think the Tlilazu would give away their strongest weapon just like that?
Then we will accept a fully operational Xlotl tank.
Waff merely stared at her. Terraza shrugged. I had to try.
I suppose you did.
Terraza sat back and reviewed what she had learned here. Waff's reaction to that Zensuni probe had been interesting. A problem that cannot be resolved by rational means. The words had produced a subtle effect on him. He had seemed to rise out of some place within himself, a questioning look in his eyes. Gods preserve us all. Is Waff a secret Zensuni? No matter the dangers, this had to be explored. Odraid must be armed with every possible advantage on Rakkas.
Perhaps we have done all we can for now, Terraza said. There is time to complete our bargain.
God alone in his infinite mercy has given us infinite universes where anything may happen. Waff clapped his hands once without thinking. The gift of surprises is the greatest gift of all, he said. Not just Zen Sunni, Terrasa thought. Sufi also. Sufi. She began to readjust her perspective on the Tlevazu. How long have they been holding this close to their breasts? Time does not count itself, Terrasa said, probing. One has only to look at any circle. Suns are circles, Waff said. Each universe is a circle. He held his breath, waiting for her response. Circles are enclosures, Terrasa said, picking the proper response out of her other memories. Whatever encloses and limits must expose itself to the infinite. Waff raised his hands to show her his palms, then dropped his arms into his lap. His shoulders lost some of their tense upward thrust. Why did you not say these things at the beginning? He asked. I must exercise great care, Terrasa cautioned herself. The admissions in Waff's words and manner required careful review. What has passed between us reveals nothing unless we speak more openly, she said. Even then, we would only be using words. Waff studied her face, trying to read in that Bene Gesserit mask some confirmation of the things implied by her words and manner. She was Pawinda, he reminded himself. The Pawinda could never be trusted. But if she shared the great belief... Did God not send his prophet to Rakis, there to test us and teach us? He asked. Terrasa delved deep into her other memories. A prophet on Rakis? Muad'Dib? No, that did not square with either Sufi or Zen Sunni beliefs in... The tyrant. She closed her mouth into a grim line. What one cannot control, one must accept, she said. For surely that is God's doing, Waff replied. Terrasa had seen and heard enough. The Missionaria Protectiva had immersed her in every known religion. Other memories reinforced this knowledge and filled it out. She felt a great need to get herself safely away from this room. Odraid must be alerted. May I make a suggestion? Terrasa asked. Waff nodded politely. Perhaps there is here the substance of a greater bond between us than we imagined, she said. I offer you the hospitality of our keep on Rakis and the services of our commander there. An Atreides? He asked. No, Terrasa lied. But I will, of course, alert our breeding mistresses to your needs. And I will assemble the things you require in payment, he said. Why will the bargain be completed on Rakis? Is that not the proper place? She asked. Who could be false in the home of the prophet? Waff sat back in his chair, his arms relaxed in his lap. Terrasa certainly knew the proper responses. It was a revelation he had never expected. Terrasa stood. Each of us listens to God personally, she said. And together in the Kel, he thought. He looked up at her, reminding himself that she was Pawinda. None of them could be trusted. Caution. This woman was, after all, a Bene Gesserit witch. They were known to create religions for their own ends. Pawinda. Terrasa went to the hatch, opened it, and gave her security signal. She turned once more toward Waff, who still sat in his chair. He has not penetrated our true design, she thought. The ones we send to him must be chosen with extreme care. He must never suspect that he is part of our bait. His elfin features composed, Waff stared back at her. How bland he looked, Terrasa thought. But he could be trapped. An alliance between Sisterhood and Tlevazu offered new attractions, but on our terms. Until Rakis, she said. What social inheritances went outward with the scattering? We know those times intimately. We know both the mental and physical settings. The lost ones took with them a consciousness confined mostly to manpower and hardware. There was a desperate need for room to expand, driven by the myth of freedom. Most had not learned the deeper lesson of the tyrant, that violence builds its own limits. The scattering was wild and random movement, interpreted as growth, expansion. It was goaded by a profound fear, often unconscious, of stagnation and death. The Scattering, Bene Gesserit Analysis, Archives. Odrade lay full length on her side along the ledge of the bow window, her cheek lightly touching the warm plaz through which she could see the great square of Keen. Her back was supported by a red cushion, which smelled of melange, as did many things here on Rakkas. Behind her lay three rooms, small but efficient, and well removed from both temple and Bene Gesserit keep. This removal had been a requirement of the sisterhood's agreement with the priests. Shiana must be guarded more securely, Odrade had insisted. She cannot become the ward of only the sisterhood, Tuwek had objected. Nor of the priests, Odrade countered. 6 stories below Odrade's bow window vantage, an enormous bazaar spread out in loosely organized confusion, almost filling the great square. The silvered yellow light of a lowering sun washed the scene with brilliance, picking out the bright colors of canopies, drawing long shadows across the uneven ground. There was a dusty radiance about the light, where scattered clumps of people milled about patched umbrellas and the jumbled alignments of wares. The great square was not actually square. It stretched out around the bazaar a full kilometer across from Odrade's window, and easily twice that distance to the left and right. A giant rectangle of packed earth and old stones, which had been churned into bitter dust by daytime shoppers braving the heat in hopes of gaining a bargain then. As evening advanced, a different sense of activity unfolded beneath Odrade. More people arriving. A quickening and more frenetic pulse to the movement. Odrade tipped her head to peer down sharply at the ground near her building. Some of the merchants directly beneath her window had wandered off to their nearby quarters. They would return soon after a meal and short siesta, ready to make full use of those more valuable hours when people in the open could breathe air that did not burn their throats. Shiana was overdue, Odrade noted. The priests dared not delay much longer. They would be working frantically now, firing questions at Shiana, admonishing her to remember that she was God's own emissary to his church, reminding Shiana of many contrived allegiances that Odrade would have to ferret out and make humorous before dispatching such trivia into proper perspective. Odrade arched her back and went through a silent minute of tiny exercises to relieve tensions. She admitted to a certain sympathy for Shiana. The girl's thoughts would be chaos right now. Shiana knew little or nothing about what to expect once she came fully under a Reverend Mother's tutelage. There was little doubt that the young mind was cluttered with myths and other misinformation. As my mind was, Odrade thought. She could not avoid remembrance at a moment such as this. Her immediate task was clear. Exorcism. Not only for Shiana, but for herself. She thought the haunting thoughts of a reverend mother in her memories. Odrade, age 5, the comfortable house on Gamu. The road outside the house is lined with what passes for middle echelon mansions in the planet's seacoast cities. Low one-story buildings on wide avenues. The houses reach far down to an outcurving sea frontage, where they are much wider than along the avenues. Only on the seaside do they become more expansive and less jealous of every square meter. Odrade's Bene Gesserit-honed memory rolled through that faraway house, its occupants, the avenue, the playmates. She felt the tightness in her breast that told her such memories were attached to later events. The Bene Gesserit creche on Aldenab's artificial world, one of the original sisterhood safe planets. Later she learned that the Bene Gesserit once considered making the entire planet into a no-chamber. Energy requirements defeated this plan. The creche was a cascade of variety to a child from Gamu's comforts and friendships. Bene Gesserit education included intense physical training. There were regular admonishments that she could not hope to become a reverend mother without passage through much pain and frequent periods of seemingly hopeless muscular exercises. Some of her companions failed at this stage. They left to become nurses, servants, laborers, casual breeders. They filled niches of necessity wherever the sisterhood required them. There were times when Audrey felt longingly that this failure might not be a bad life. Fewer responsibilities, lesser goals. That had been before she emerged from primary training. I thought of it as emerging, coming through victorious. I came out the other side, only to find yourself immersed in new and harsher demands. Audrey sat up on her Rakian window ledge and pushed her cushion aside. She turned her back on the bazaar. It was becoming noisier out there. Damned priests. They were stretching delay to its absolute limits. I must think about my own childhood, because that will help me with Shiana, she thought. Immediately she sneered at her own weakness. Another excuse. It took some postulants at least 50 years to become reverend mothers. This was ground into them during secondary training, a lesson of patience. Audrey showed an early penchant for deep study. There was consideration that she might become one of the Bene Gesserit mentats, and probably an archivist. This idea was dropped on the discovery that her talents lay in a more profitable direction. She was aimed at more sensitive duties in Chapter House. Security. That wild talent among the Atreides often had this employment. Care with details, that was Audrey's hallmark. She knew her sisters could predict some of her actions simply from their deep knowledge of her. Taraza did it regularly. Audrey had overheard the explanation from Taraza's own lips. Audrey's persona is exquisitely reflected in her performance of duties. There was a joke in Chapter House. Where does Audrey go when she's off duty? She goes to work. Chapter House imposed little need to adopt the covering masks that a reverend mother used automatically on the outside. She might show emotions momentarily, deal openly with mistakes of her own and of others, feel sad or bitter or even sometimes happy. Men were available not for breeding but for occasional solace. All such Bene Gesserit Chapter House males were quite charming, and a few were even sincere in their charm. These few, of course, were much in demand. Emotions. Recognition twisted through Audrey's mind. So I come to it as I always do. Audrey felt the warm evening sunlight of Rakis on her back. She knew where her body sat, but her mind opened itself to the coming encounter with Shiana. Love. It would be so easy and so dangerous. In this moment she envied the station mothers, the ones allowed to live out a lifetime with a mated breeding partner. Miles Tay came from such a union. Other memories told her how it had been for the Lady Jessica and her Duke. Even Wadib had chosen that form of mating. It is not for me. Audrey admitted to a bitter jealousy that she had not been permitted such a life. What were the compensations of the life into which she had been guided? A life without love can be devoted more intensely to the sisterhood. We provide our own forms of support to the initiated. Do not worry about sexual enjoyment. That is available whenever you feel the need. With charming men. Since the days of the Lady Jessica, through the tyrant's times and beyond, many things had changed, including the Bene Gesserit. Every reverend mother knew it. A deep sigh shuddered through Audrey. She glanced back over her shoulder at the bazaar. Still no sign of Shiana. I must not love this child. It was done. Audrey knew she had played out the mnemonic game in its required Bene Gesserit form. She swiveled her body and sat cross-legged on the ledge. It was a commanding view of the bazaar and over the rooftops of the city and its basin. Those few remnant hills out there, south of here, were, she knew, the last of what had been the shield wall of Dune, the high ramparts of basement rock breached by Moadib and his sandworm-mounted legions. Heat danced from the ground beyond the Kanat and canal that protected Keen from intrusions by the new worms. Odraid smiled softly. The priests found nothing strange in moting their communities to keep their divided god from intruding upon them. We will worship you, God, but don't bother us. This is our religion, our city. You see, we no longer call this place Arrakeen. Now it's Keen. The planet no longer is Dune or Arrakis. Now it's Arrakis. Keep your distance, God. You are the past, and the past is an embarrassment. Odraid stared at those distant hills dancing in the heat shimmer. Other memories could superimpose the ancient landscape. She knew that past. If the priests delay bringing Shiana much longer, I will punish them. Heat still filled the bazaar below her, held there by storage in the ground and the thick walls surrounding the great square. Temperature diffusion was amplified by the smoke of many small fires lighted in the surrounding buildings and among the tent-sheltered congeries of life scattered through the bazaar. It had been a hot day, well above 38 degrees. This building, though, had been a fish speaker center in the old days and was cooled by Ixian machinery with evaporation pools on the roof. We will be comfortable here. And they would be as secure as Bene Gesserit protective measures could make them. Reverend mothers walked those halls out there. The priests had their representatives in the building, but none of those would intrude where Odraid did not want them. Shiana would meet with them here on occasion, but the occasions would be only as Odraid permitted. It is happening, Odraid thought. Taraza's plan moves ahead. Fresh in Odraid's mind was the latest communication from Chapter House. What that revealed about Lathlilazu filled Odraid with excitement that she carefully dampened. This Waff, this Lathlilazu master, would be a fascinating study. Zensuni and Sufi. A ritual pattern frozen for millennia, Taraza said. Unspoken in Taraza's report was another message. Taraza is placing her complete confidence in me. Odraid felt strength flow into her from this awareness. Shiana is the fulcrum. We are the lever. Our strength will come from many sources. Odraid relaxed. She knew that Shiana would not permit the priests to delay much longer. Odraid's own patience had suffered the assaults of anticipation. It would be worse for Shiana. They had become conspirators, Odraid and Shiana. The first step. It was a marvelous game to Shiana. She had been born and bred to distrust priests. What fun to have an ally at last. Some form of activity stirred the people directly below Odraid's window. She peered downward, curious. Five naked men there had linked arms in a circle. Their robes and stillsuits lay in a pile at one side, watched over by a dark-skinned young girl in a long brown dress of spice fiber. Her hair was bound by a red rag. Dancers. Odraid had seen many reports of this phenomenon, but this was her first personal view of it since arriving. The onlookers included a trio of tall priest guardians in yellow helmets with high crests. The guardians wore short robes that freed their legs for action, and each carried a metal-clad staff. As the dancers circled, the watchful crowd grew predictably restive. Odraid knew the pattern. Soon there would be a chanting outcry and a great melee. Heads would be cracked. Blood would flow. People would scream and run about. Eventually, it would all subside without official intervention. Some would go away weeping. Some would depart laughing. And the priest guardians would not interfere. The pointless insanity of this dance and its consequences had fascinated the Bene Gesserit for centuries. Now it held Odraid's rapt attention. the devolution of this ritual had been followed by the Missionario Protectiva. Rakians called it Dance Diversion. They had other names for it as well, and the most significant was Sayenak. This dance was what had become of the tyrant's greatest ritual, his moment of sharing with his fish speakers. Odrade recognized and respected the energy in this phenomenon. No Reverend Mother could fail to see that. The waste of it, however, disturbed her. Such things should be channeled and focused. This ritual needed some useful employment. All it did now was drain away forces that might prove destructive to the priests if left untapped. A sweet fruit odor wafted into Odrade's nostrils. She sniffed and looked at the vents beside her window. Heat from the mob and the warmed earth created an updraft. This carried odors from below through the Ixian vents. She pressed her forehead and nose against the plaza to peer directly downward. Huh. The dancers, or the mob, had tipped over a merchant's stall. The dancers were stomping in the fruit. Yellow pulp spurted up to their thighs. Odrade recognized the fruit merchant among the onlookers, a familiar, wizened face she had seen several times at a stall beside her building's entrance. He appeared unconcerned by his loss. Like all the others around him, he concentrated his attention on the dancers. The five naked men moved with a disjointed high lift of their feet, an unrhythmic and seemingly uncoordinated display, which came around periodically to a repeated pattern. Three of the dancers, with both feet on the ground, and the other two held aloft by their partners. Odrade recognized it. This was related to the ancient Fremen way of sand walking. This curious dance was a fossil with roots in the need to move without signaling your presence to a worm. People began to crowd nearer the dancers out of the bazaar's gray triangle, hopping upward like children's toys to raise their eyes above the throng for a glimpse of the five naked men. Odrade saw Shiana's escort then. Movement far off to the right, where a wide avenue entered the square. Animal track symbols on a building there said the wide avenue was God's way. Historical awareness said the avenue had been Leto II's route into the city, from his high-walled Sarir, far off to the south. With a care for details, one could still discern some of the forms and patterns that had been the tyrant city of Un, the festival center built around the more ancient city of Arakeen. An had obliterated many marks of Arakeen, but some avenues persisted. Some buildings were too useful to replace. Buildings inevitably defined streets. Shiana's escort came to a stop where the avenue debarched into the bazaar. Yellow-helmeted guardians probed ahead, clearing a path with their staves. The guards were tall. When grounded, the thick, 2-meter staff would come only to the shoulders of the shortest among them. Even in the most disordered crowd, you could not miss a priest guardian, but Shiana's protectors were the tallest of the tall. They were in motion once more, leading their party toward Odrade. Their robes swung open at each stride, revealing the slick gray of the best stillsuits. They walked straight ahead, 15 of them in a shallow V, which skirted the thicker clusters of stalls. A loose band of priestesses, with Shiana at their center, marched behind the guards. Odrade caught glimpses of Shiana's distinctive figure, that sun-streaked hair and proudly upthrust face, within her escort. It was the yellow-helmeted priest guardians, though, who attracted Odrade's attention. They moved with an arrogance conditioned into them from infancy. These guards knew they were better than the ordinary folk, and the ordinary folk reacted predictably by opening a way for Shiana's party. It was all done so naturally that Odrade could see the ancient pattern of it, as though she watched another ritual dance, which had not changed in millennia. As she had often done, Odrade thought of herself now as an archaeologist, not one who sifted the dusty detritus of the ages, but rather a person who focused where the sisterhood frequently concentrated its awareness. on the ways people carried their past within them. The tyrant's own design was apparent here. Shiana's approach was a thing laid down by the God Emperor himself. Beneath Audrey's window, the five naked men continued to dance. Among the onlookers, however, Audrey saw a new awareness. Without any concerted turning of heads toward the approaching phalanx of priest guardians, the watchers below Audrey knew. Animals always know when the herders arrive. Now the crowd's restiveness produced a quicker pulse. They would not be denied their chaos. A clod of dirt flew from the throng's outskirts and struck the ground near the dancers. The five men did not miss a step in their extended pattern, but their speed increased. The length of the series between repetitions spoke of remarkable memories. Another clod of dirt flew from the crowd and struck a dancer's shoulder. None of the five men faltered. The crowd began to scream and chant. Some shouted curses. The chanting became a hand-clapping intrusion onto the dancers' movements. Still, the pattern did not change. The mob's chanting became a harsh rhythm, repeated shouts that echoed against the great square's walls. They were trying to break the dancers' pattern. Audrey sensed a profound importance in the scene below her. Shiana's party had come more than halfway across the bazaar. They moved through the wider lanes between stalls and turned now directly toward Audrey. The crowd was at its densest about 50 meters ahead of the priest guardians. The guardians moved at a steady pace, disdainful of those who scurried aside. Under the yellow helmets, eyes were fixed straight ahead, staring over the mob. Not one of the advancing guardians gave any outward sign that he saw a mob, or dancers, or any other barrier that might impede him. The mob stopped its chanting abruptly, as though an invisible conductor had waved his hand for silence. The five men continued to dance. The silence below Audrey was charged with a power that made her neck hairs stand up. Directly below Audrey, the three priest guardians among the onlookers turned as one man and moved out of view into her building. Deep within the crowd, a woman shouted a curse. The dancers gave no sign that they heard.